Those moving parts are all moving. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to this post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today I'm joined by Steve from Canstar. Hi, Steve.
G'day, Martin.
Every time we catch up, there's always plenty to talk about because there's so many moving parts to the story of finance and households, right?
But and look, new bits keep being added all the time, as they were just a couple of days ago by APRA. So, there's always something on the go.
Yes, and I wonder how sometimes people who aren't studying this all the time keep track. Maybe they follow you and me and other people to try and get the insights, which means we've got a useful purpose in life, I suppose.
Exactly. I mean, I guess we all live in interesting time, and if we can help people out a little bit with that, we'll all the better.
Absolutely. Well, let's pick the conversation up with APRA first, because, of course, APRA came out, I think, a little surprisingly in some ways, and basically said, right, we're going to lift the hurdle rate, the buffer rate, from 2.5% to 3%. What's your perspective? Because, of course, some banks were already above the 3%, weren't they?
Yeah, they were. So it doesn't make a whole lot of difference there. I feel like the guru, actually, Martin, because 2 days before that, I said, they'll do something. They must do something. So I was of the view that they had to do something. And it's not a huge step. Now, what they've done, of course, is that they've increased the buffer from 2.5% to 3%. Now, that's an interest rate buffer. For people who don't know what this is about, you're not paying a higher rate. Don't worry about that. It's all about increasing the interest rate buffer, the amount above that you're actually paying, when the bank assesses your ability to repay. So if you're borrowing at 2%, now they're adding a 3% buffer, and they say, can you afford these repayments if the interest rate today was 5%? And it's all about building in that bit of redundancy so that if and when, it's actually when, interest rates go up, that you can afford the repayments.
Yes, absolutely. So it's the buffer rate they use for calculations. Some banks, of course, were actually already above the 3%. CBA, for example, put theirs up relatively recently. And in fact, the CEO, Matt Cumming at CBA, was arguing that other banks should do the same.
Yeah, look, and I get it too, because we are at record low interest rates, and it's not realistic to think in 2 years' time we'll be at those levels again. So you have to expect an increase. And when you remember that we're on 8% interest rates prior to the GFC, now that's 10 years and a bit ago now, but we were up at 8%. Now there's no reason to believe we will not at some point in an interest rate cycle be back to those levels. So we will be paying more. And this is about saying, look, we can never guarantee anything, but we're at least going to be a little bit more confident that there'll be ability to repay. And APRA will have taken all of that into account. They'd have looked at this runaway market, and they'd have said, look, prices are just getting so far ahead of wages that it doesn't look sustainable. They'll have looked at it and said interest rates will get ahead of wage increases. So we've got to build something in here. We don't want banks getting carried away. We don't want borrowers getting carried away. We just want to slow it up that little bit. And one of the interesting things that's happened in the last couple of weeks is that two of the big lenders in the market have cut their interest-only rates for owner-occupiers. Now, APRA would look at that and say, gee, we're not quite sure that this is the right time to be encouraging people into interest-only. So put the buffer on there and make sure people can at least afford more today than they're actually being asked to pay.
And my theory, Steve, I don't know what yours is, but my theory is a lot of it is actually optics and psychology, right? The fact that APRA has done something will actually give people a bit of a jolt. The quantum is quite small, but it shows also, of course, that they are willing to act. And they did say in their statement yesterday that they will be perhaps making other moves later as well. So this should be seen as the first harbinger of a number of things they could do.
Look, I think it absolutely is. And I think what they're effectively saying to the banks is, look, you make sure that you keep your face clean. You stay clean here. You keep your credit standards going. Because if we get the inkling that banks are not doing that, we can go a lot harder than this.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is interesting, of course, because yesterday New Zealand, the Reserve Bank of New Zealand, lifted the cash rate. You know, people were expecting in August. They didn't do it then, but they've done it now. And I noticed that overnight Iceland lifted their cash rate too. So we are seeing central banks beginning to perhaps turn the knob the other direction in terms of interest rates. And interestingly, Iceland also imposed stronger loan-to-income and loan-to-value limits on mortgages because they were expressing concern about what's happening in Iceland. About half of all credit in Iceland is for mortgages. We've got 60% here. And they're worried that house prices have sort of shot up by somewhere between 6 and 10%. And they think that's way too much. So if you compare the relatives of Iceland versus ourselves, we should be doing a whole lot more.
This isn't sea change. This is ice change, I suppose. But yeah, I guess. I mean, the Reserve Bank, ABRA, the government, want to sort of tread a fine line here because they know that we need still need stimulus to recover out of COVID lockdowns. So they don't want to go too hard, but they do want to put the brakes on a bit. It's an interesting conundrum too they're facing because, all right, APRA says this is all about the system, and it is all about the system, but they also do keep their eye on property prices being running away prices and know that that's bad for the system. But it's also bad for first home buyers, and they'd be worried about that. Now, this does hurt first home buyers' ability to repay. You know, they can borrow about 5% less is really what this means. If they can borrow 5% less, if the constraint on what they can borrow is about their ability to service the loan. Now, in a lot of cases with first home buyers, the real pain point is getting enough deposit together to be able to borrow for the home. So they're not going to be as hard hit as they might have been if the Reserve Bank had said, we're going to put a higher deposit requirement, a higher equity requirement, in other words, a lower loan-to-value ratio. That would have hurt first-time buyers a lot more. And the other thing with this one is that it actually hurts investors more because investors have the home they live in, the investment property they're buying, and maybe another couple of investment properties. And this buffer will be added on to all of those when they're applying for a new investment loan. So it's probably going to put the brakes on them, probably more, I'd say, than first-time buyers.
Right. An interesting question, Steve, is what happens when a existing borrower comes back to refinance, right? Will the lender then have to apply a bigger buffer than they currently did?
Yeah, they will. And that's an interesting point because when refinancing, it's a whole new deal for that bank. So yeah, they will have to do that. They'll have to apply a higher buffer. So people are going to have to say, well, gee, maybe that refinance option isn't necessarily available to me anymore, even though there's no difference to me and no difference to the system I'm just moving my loan. They still might have to say, well, I'm locked out of that for the time being until my wage goes up.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that I've always said to people is, just be a little bit more conservative perhaps than you might at first blush want to be, simply because of these uncertainties, because it's not necessarily just now, it's what happens in 2 or 3 years' time. No guarantees that income are really going to start taking off anytime soon, so you can't assume you're going to have a lot more money coming in at that point. So there are some potential traps for the unwary. Another interesting
point. Yeah, there are.
Go on. Yeah, the other point I was just going to make was that in New Zealand, of course, the Reserve Bank of New Zealand specifically mentioned in its release that, one, house prices were unsustainable and the growth of house prices were unsustainable, and that they were thinking about the impact of house prices on their monetary policy. So when they lifted rates, they were thinking about the fact that it would ease house price growth. Here in Australia, of course, neither APRA nor RBA want to claim any responsibility for house price dynamics at all.
They don't. APRA was very clear that this is about system stability. They didn't say this about house prices. Now, house prices is part of that because if they go too far too fast, then there will be a correction and there'll be a mess to clean up with people failing to repay loans then. But nevertheless, they're very keen to stress this is about system stability. The RBA is very clear that we're all about inflation and that means jobs and GDP to extent, but we're all about jobs. Now, there's only in New Zealand, they don't have that same separation of the two roles. It's like the old RBA used to have all that responsibility. That's still the case in New Zealand, as I understand it. So it's not, you know, it's sort of like there's less of this going on, I guess, Martin, in the New Zealand market.
Well, actually, what happened there a few months ago was that the government in New Zealand put that extra accountability onto the Reserve Bank of New Zealand. Prior to that, they had no specific accountability to think about house prices. So it's actually been government policy that's driven that.
Yeah, well, if it's one of your KPIs, and it is, the RBA is very keen to say our only KPI is getting into the inflation band. That's the only one that's in black ink, as far as I understand it. They haven't achieved it for a few years, though.
Funny that. Neither the wages growth expectations. So, yeah. I've often said, you know, if the Reserve Bank was being paid on results, they'd be a lot poorer.
I think they'd have been on performance management for years and years ago.
Now, when it comes to the current story on interest rates, let's just talk about mortgage rates. You mentioned that there were some cuts for interest-only loans. In other words, people were trying to, you know, get more cheap loans. What's the mix? Are people putting rates up, putting rates down, or what's going on?
Yeah, rates are still going down. I've got so many bits of paper here. 24 lenders, Martin, in September put variable rates down by 0.22%. Now, fixed loans have gone, seven lenders went down, basically by the same margin. So what's effectively happening there is that they're bumping down their short-term fixed rates, so the 1 and 2 years, and they're bumping up their 4 and 5 year rates in particular, and it's a reshuffle. But effectively, if you look at the bank's behaviour here, they're saying, look, we still think interest rates are going to go up. We think, we're a bit more bearish about that than the Reserve Bank. We think they'll go up earlier than the Reserve Bank is saying. And they want to keep more of their loan book on variables so that they can reprice that very easily when the Reserve Bank pushes rates up. So I think that's a very good signal that we should not be saying this whole issue of interest rates and interest rate buffers is in the imagination of a regulator, because it's not. The banks are basically saying virtually the same thing. You see that in that behavior.
Mm. And the rate is, you know, the rates are the best indicator, rather, because they're basically thinking about what the forward yield curve is going to be going to, and that's being driven by future expectations of interest rates. And, you know, around the world, in fact, interest rate curves have moved positive, partly because there's a fear of inflation.
Yeah, and look, trying to fund a fixed term beyond 3 years right now is very difficult. Can you imagine a depositor saying, I'm prepared to lock in for 3 years a term deposit and you'll be good enough to give me 1.3% for that? Well, you know what? People won't do it. And that goes for wholesale funders as well. They're in the same category. People have to raise the money somewhere. You're not going to get five-year money and four-year money at a sensible price from depositors, nor will you get it in wholesale markets.
Right. And the other side of the equation, of course, is deposit rates. Are they still drifting down, or are we seeing any return up?
Yeah. There's no one's going up. they're drifting down a little bit more slowly, Martin. There was quite an avalanche at one stage there, and right now it's a little bit slower than it was. But they're still drifting down. You know, people are shaving, you know, 5 or 10 basis points from savings accounts, and the top rates are coming down. The average rates are coming down. So there's no safe haven there, and unfortunately, people are stuck with, I think, at least another couple of years before they start seeing rates start to move up, but that will only be start. It's going to be a long time before you're getting a reasonable return out of bank deposits.
Right. And, of course, if you take account of what inflation is properly doing at the moment, in negative rates on net, right, so in real terms, you're actually losing money if you have money in deposit accounts.
Yeah, if you think, look, I'm going to live off the interest, well, that means you're not putting any interest back in. So you've got a stable principal amount, and that stable principal amount is going to be worth less in 2 or 3 years' time, even with low inflation, because it still gradually erodes and compounds the eroding of your principal, of your spending power of that $100,000 you got saved. If you actually withdraw the interest to live off, you're even worse off because you're not, sorry, that was withdrawn. Even if you're plugging all of the interest back in, you're still not keeping pace with inflation.
Yep, so absolutely. So it's being devalued in real terms, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And it's why people are looking for assets to put their savings into that will appreciate. And you know, that might be stocks, it might be property. But of course, at that point, you're taking a high level of risk relative to sticking it in the bank. So, you know, there's a great argument yet again for diversifying your asset classes and hopefully be able to ride out a storm in the higher risk parts of your portfolio, but have the cash to live off in the meantime. But it's a tricky time for self-funded retirees in particular, because they will be eroding their capital a lot faster. They expect to erode your capital in retirement, but a lot faster than they would have hoped.
Absolutely. And of course, some people are looking at crypto thinking, well, that was a big move of the last few days. But again, if you think of the risk spectrum, crypto's right up there at the top. So I wouldn't put all my money there, frankly.
Well, I mean, I guess buying a Tesla lotto ticket's a little higher risk, Martin, than crypto. But nevertheless, I think you're right. There's no sort of underlying fundamental about crypto that says there's a flaw and it's got to be worth that much. Nobody knows if there is actually a flaw. If the market decides it doesn't like a cryptocurrency, which are one of them or all of them, well, where is the flaw? Where does it stop? There's nothing you can sell to say, look, that's going to mean that at least it's worth $10, $20, $50. There's nothing that you can sell to say each coin is worth this. It just if sentiment turns too badly against them, well, it can just disappear altogether.
Yeah, so it is very much driven just by market sentiment up and down. I sometimes say I think crypto is more like a religion than anything else, because those who believe in it and will think it'll always go up, and others who are more doubtful are a bit more concerning, and there are agnostics like myself saying, well, there's some interesting things to it, but there's also some big risks to it. So
there is. Yeah. It's an interesting one, all the same. I mean, if you've got a very large portfolio, you might say, well, look, I'm prepared to throw 4 or 5% of it into crypto, maybe even a bit more. If you've got a very large portfolio and you can afford to lose, you might say, look, the gains on this thing have been crazy. It might still continue to be crazy. And if it doesn't work well, you know what? I'm not out on the street. But if you are down to your sort of a small level that you need to live off, well, you've got a little bit harder than that. But if you were to go into it, you'd say, add with that higher level of investment, well, you'd say, well, look, you know what? This is all about diversification. And if crypto fails, well, chances are something else will do okay for you.
Absolutely. Well, of course, diversification is absolutely critical. And at the moment, if you look at stocks, they're overvalued. If you look at property, it's probably overvalued. So you start thinking, well, hang on a moment. Is there any sort of real value anywhere, or is it all relative risk, right?
Yeah, which is why you diversify, of course, because you've got to take this long-term view, and you sort of look at them and think, well, where would I put my money? Let's say I don't have faith in stocks at the moment. What am I going to do, cash out and buy a property? That looks a bit pricey too at the moment. Well, if I put in cash in the bank, well, I earn nothing there and go backwards through inflation. So there's no great safe haven. So you buy diversified different asset classes, and within the asset class, diversify as much as you can, and say, well, all right, something might do okay, and surely something will not do okay. It's tricky. I mean, people have always bought gold in these times of uncertainty because they say, well, if it all goes to hell in a handbasket, at least gold might be that store of value that will do okay for me. I'm not saying to everyone run out and buy gold, simply.
Well, the gold price is down from where it was a few months ago. So, yeah, again, it just shows you that nothing is certain in this world other than uncertainty.
Yeah, well, the funny thing is about it, a lot of the crypto fans do say, well, look, this is the new gold. But it's virtual gold. It's not shiny yellow stuff. It's virtual gold.
Well, I find it amazing that Bitcoin has lots of images of coins, right, with a Bitcoin on the front, right? You know, it's digital, but yet they actually want to show that it's tangible. So that shows something about the psychology, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, it does actually. And funnily enough, the color of the Bitcoin is gold. So, you know, surprise, surprise. But yes, the parallel was perhaps always there in the back of people's minds. Who would imagine it was in people's minds when they founded this thing? Because it was, I don't think anyone would have thought it would take off like this.
No, and you know, the fact is that people would argue that there's limited supply of gold as there is with cryptos, and for that reason maybe there is some parallels, but actually there are also some differences too, so it's just worth thinking about it quite hard before you sort of get swept away and throw your last few dollars into crypto and saying, well, you know, it's bound to go up. Well, maybe it will, maybe it won't, who knows.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I agree with gold, there are a lot of parallels, there's no question, because the value of gold when it gets up on those ethereal heights is way above any underlying value that gold has. It's way in excess of the value that it has for jewellery and way in excess of any industrial value, miles ahead of all of that. The difference is, of course, that gold has been around for tens of thousands of years, hundreds of thousands of years, and there is some track record, albeit that it's ups and downs. Crypto has been around for, a decade, see that?
That's right, and then if the power goes down or the networks go down, it could be a little bit embarrassing. Let's just go on before we finish today, Steve, because I know that you've got some information about credit cards, right? The balances on credit cards are continuing to drop.
Yeah, credit cards. The debt has gone down, the debt paying interest, which is great news. And you know we're in a lockdown, so there's less opportunity to spend, and people have chosen the opportunity to actually cash down, to actually run down their balances on credit card, which is actually great news. And this is two months in a row, so they're the kind of months of the Sydney Melbourne lockdown. So that's pretty good news, actually, that credit card debt is coming down. It means that people have, they've built a buffer. If you want to think of a credit card limit as a buffer, they've built a buffer, but also they're cutting expensive debt out. Now, I think once we get out of lockdown, there could be a real blowout, because we've surveyed people's spending expectations, and 30% of people say their first spend out of lockdown is going to be on travel. 6% say houses, necessarily, which is a big number. But 30% say travel, and they have a whole bunch of other things. And in fact, if you look at the measure a bit differently, 60% of people say they do plan to travel in the short term after lockdown. There will be, I think, an increase at some point in credit card debt, and I think it will at the very least be a slowdown in the reduction of it. Because people do say, look, we've been locked up, we need to actually get out and do something and draw a line under this and blow off some steam. And itchy feet and travel are a great way to do that.
Yes, it's interesting because, of course, if the international borders open, people perhaps will prefer to travel overseas rather than interstate, which may mean that some of the tourist businesses in Queensland and elsewhere who are hoping for interstate, deluges, as it were, might be a bit disappointed.
Yeah, it's actually not such bad news. It's more or less a 50-50 kind of mix between domestic and Australian domestic and international travel. So, you know, if half of those people end up traveling domestically, well, gee, that's great, because the industry has done it really, really tough. But also internationally, if you look at sort of the big travel companies around Australia, they've done it really tough through this period.
Yep.
So their revenues and their workers' salaries, et cetera, are all tied to overseas travel taking off. So I think it's actually good news that this is happening. I just hope that people don't undo all of the good work that's happened. You know, if there's one, there's probably only one really good thing that's come out of this this whole episode for us, and that is that over the 18 months of COVID, we've knocked sort of $8 or $9 billion, almost a third, off the amount of credit card debt paying interest.
Absolutely.
So wow, you know, don't undo all that good work in a spending spree.
That's right. And just remember, folks, that credit card interest rates have not followed suit if you compare rates with mortgage rates. They're still pretty high, aren't they, Steve?
Oh, yeah. Look, we had a look around a couple of months back. I was just curious, and I found, I think, one credit card that had reduced the interest rate, and maybe another one that reduced it as a special for a while, but then it bounced up to the old rate a couple of months later. So they're not coming down at all. The lowest rates are sort of around 10%. There are a couple of real outliers, but a bit below that. And you can get, you know, 13% cards at some of the big banks, maybe a little better. But a whole lot of those that provide those cards also provide 21, 22, 23% cards. And they're rewards cards. Now, if you leave debt on your card, don't be at the top end of their product range, be at the lower priced end of the product range, because no rewards you're earning are going to actually compensate you for paying 10 percentage points too much on your debt.
Absolutely. Well, I often say to people, you know, if you are revolving, you are going to be paying a lot more. So the best way to use those cards is, if you want to rack up rewards points, do, but then just pay it off every month.
Yeah, look, if you're looking at rewards points are great if you're doing exactly what you're saying, Martin, pay it off every month. Don't look at rewards points, though. If you leave debt on your card, pay it off as fast as you can, because that's very expensive debt. It's sort of even if you're in one of the loan cards, 10% compared to 2% on your home loan, wow, that's a big difference.
Absolutely. All right. Well, as we come to the end of our show, we should just, I think, come back to one more question. That is the refinancing trend. I'm still seeing a lot of people still not yet refinanced to the best rates they can get.
They're not, Martin. I'm fishing around with these numbers, but here I have it. ABS comes out with lending stats is what I'm looking at, folks. Mm. It's the refinance is up for August to 6.53 billion from 5.8, so about $700 million up. But it's a drop in the bucket compared to the outstanding loans there. And the average interest rate for an owner-occupier now is 3.14%. You can get 180 loans or something, you know, that the CanStar lists that have rates below 2%, and a difference of 1.14% on your home loan, say a $500,000 home loan, is about $300 a month. Now that's a lot of money, and too few people are actually refinancing.
Absolutely. Well, we always preach this gospel when you and I get together, because we both care passionately about this, you know, and I can't understand why people are happy just to pay over the odds so that the bank's profits are bolstered rather than getting the money yourself. It doesn't make any sense to me, but hey, we can only say it a few again and again.
People always complain about big salaries in banks. Well, you contribute to those big salaries if you're paying the average home loan rate. So don't do it.
Absolutely. Steve, as always, great to catch up again. Thank you very much for your insights. And we'll put the links to CanStar, great source of great information if people want to find those good rates that are out there. And I'm sure we'll be picking up and talking again, because there's always plenty to talk about, isn't there?
There is, Martin. And enjoyed it as always. So thank you.
Thank you very much. See you. Bye.
Cheers.